the fielders, or the crowd, so I must be in control of myself. The great Stan Musial said, when a pitcher's throwing a spitball, don't worry, don't complain, just hit the dry side like I do. During spring training in 1994, I gave a talk to the Seattle Mariners pitching staff. The lesson that day was about responsibility psychology. Gathered on the bright green grass field at the club's new complex in Peoria, Arizona, I shared Maddox's quote. I reminded the players that while they can't always control what happens, they can always control how they respond to it. After the speech, my cell phone rang. I recognized the Oklahoma accent immediately. It was Buddy Ryan, the new head coach of the NFL Cardinals. As the Cardinals' team counselor for 6 years, I had met Buddy a few weeks earlier at the NFL Scouting Combine in Indianapolis. In hopes of making a good impression, I conducted a series of video interviews with prospective draft choices at the Combine. Gary, can you stop by today? Sure, Buddy, I said. Be there in an hour. Leaving Peoria, I turned my car south toward the Cardinals complex in Tempe. Buddy's call had left me in good spirits. I was proud of the video interviews and felt they would be a useful player evaluation tool for the new coach who had come to the Cardinals from the Houston Oilers. In Houston, Buddy had made national headlines after he threw a punch at fellow assistant coach Kevin Gilbride while the two were on the sideline during a game. Buddy made big news again when he arrived in Arizona and announced, "You've got a winner in town." I was eager to hear his plans for the upcoming season. Ryan greeted me outside his office. It was St. Patrick's Day. He wore a green necktie, and a green carnation bloomed from his jacket lapel. Ruddy-faced, eyes twinkling, and all smiles, Buddy looked as Irish as Finian's rainbow. Inside his office, where I had spent many hours with his predecessor, Joe Bugle, Buddy plopped down behind his giant desk. I took a seat across from him. "Gary, I've talked to the coaches. They've got a lot of respect for you," Buddy said. I was beaming, inside and out. "The players like you. They trust you. I've heard nothing but good things. But I'm letting you go." Boom. I felt as if I had been slapped. My heart sank. The big smile fell off my face. As I sat in stunned silence, shock and disappointment suddenly gave way to a rush of anger. "This isn't fair," I thought. I felt my jaw tighten and my fists clench. For an instant, I pictured myself flying across the desk and delivering to my ex-boss the same kind of statement Ryan had delivered to Gilbride during a flash of anger in the heat of a big game. Then I caught myself. An hour earlier, I had been standing in the warm sunshine in Peoria lecturing a group of major league pitchers on being responsible. I had told them they can't always control the situation. All they can control is how they respond to it. Forcing myself, I sat back in my chair. I took a deep breath and looked Ryan in the eye. "Buddy, I really wish you had taken the time to get to know me," I heard myself saying in a level voice. "I think I can help you and the team, but I understand. I want to wish you good luck." We stood and shook hands. "You still going to be a Cardinals fan?" Ryan asked. I told him I would. Then I left his office, consciously holding my head high. I had to walk my talk, although at that moment it wasn't easy to do. While you can't always control what happens, you always can control how you respond to it. It's not the situation, but how you respond to it that makes the difference. Getting over yourself. I worked very hard. I felt I could play the game. The only thing that could stop me was myself. Jim Abbott. This ability to conquer oneself is no doubt the most precious of all things sports bestows upon us. Olga Corbett. Rafael Colon is my bilingual counselor for the Mariners and president of Voices Internacional. On his voicemail is this message. To achieve anything you want in life, you must first start by getting out of your own way. Robert Kelly's Pogo cartoon puts it another way. We have met the enemy, and they is us. Working in the field of sports psychology, I am fascinated by how many people defeat themselves and sabotage success. Athletes at every level often interfere with their own performance. They get in their own way with their fears, their doubts, and their self-condemning nature. In 1994, pitcher Sean Estes underwent surgery on his left shoulder, but his problems in the Mariners organization went beyond injuries. When I did well, I didn't give myself enough credit, he said. When I did badly, I beat myself up for it. After that season, the left-hander went to the Arizona Instructional League. I worked with Sean all winter, helping him focus on things he could control. Forget errors and bad umpire calls. Estes came to understand what Arthur Ashe said. You were really never playing an opponent. You were playing yourself. Once Estes learned how to get out of his own way, he became an all-star with the San Francisco Giants. A person's self-concept is vitally important. On his deathbed, Sigmund Freud said, "The essence of success in life is love and work." As individuals, we all want to feel lovable and capable. If you don't feel good about yourself, you tend not to perform well. Those who have a negative self-image find ways to self-destruct. Daryl Strawberry is a prime example. Why would an athlete blessed with so much talent and given so many opportunities to succeed continually defeat himself with drug abuse? In psychology, there is something we call the self-consistency theory. It means that we act consistent to our self-concept, our self-image. Throughout this book, we will talk about the importance of seeing yourself as being successful. If you don't see yourself as successful, then your chances of succeeding are diminished. When good things happen, you tend to discount them. We all have self-defeating thoughts and behaviors that undermine performance. I call them gremlins, the little invisible creatures that prevent athletes from performing at their best. Here's my gremlin checklist. If any one of them sounds familiar, you might want to listen to the section that deals with it specifically. Fear. We all have a primitive fight-or-flight mechanism built into us to survive. It's a neurochemical response. We are ready to fight or flee whatever is threatening us. As we learned earlier, the body treats all vivid images as if they are real and happening now. In reality, most dangers are not a threat to life or limb. They are a psychological threat to self-esteem and ego. Why else would a brain surgeon turn to jelly over a 4-foot downhill breaking putt? It's a threat to self-image. Fear actually can paralyze you. Anger. We have to learn to control our emotions, or they will control us. Anger is born out of frustration and expectations. Our minds and bodies don't always work together, as illustrated in a Peanuts cartoon. Lucy is holding the ball for Charlie Brown to kick. When he misses, Lucy tells him he has to use his mind and body. Charlie Brown informs Lucy that his mind and body haven't talked to each other in years. Anxiety. This is a generalized feeling of uncertainty or dread, a sense that something bad is going to happen. In baseball, some pitchers look great warming up on the side, but once they step across the chalk line and onto the field, they don't perform well. We call this white line fever. We all become anxious, but people plagued by this gremlin get anxious about being anxious. This only leads to trouble. Self-consciousness. Some athletes are afraid of looking bad or embarrassing themselves. They focus on the image of how they look instead of the task at hand. Ozzie Smith said, "Show me a guy who is afraid of looking bad, and I can beat him every time." You can't perform well if you're afraid of embarrassing yourself. Perfectionism. Sean Estes was his own worst enemy because he was never satisfied with his performance. Self-critical, negative perfectionists can never do enough. Their mindset often is fueled by a fear of failure. Perfectionists often have a very critical, self-condemning voice. I believe perfectionism often comes from conditional parenting. Many Little League parents don't realize the damage they do to their child's self-esteem with their negative comments. When you tell a Little Leaguer that he failed, you're telling him that he is a failure. Children internalize criticism. Critical, condemning coaches who use fear and embarrassment injure a young person's psychological health. Stubbornness. Some people are stubborn, unwilling to learn. They're not open to change. They believe the devil they know is better than the devil they don't know. They aren't going to take risks that will help them reach the next level. This is unfortunate because in sports, you must learn how to fail successfully. Lack of motivation. Some athletes simply lack the drive to become the best they can be. You can't buy motivation. You can't obtain it from someone else. Motivation is something nobody else can give you, Joe DiMaggio said. Others can help motivate you, but basically it must come from you, and it must be a constant desire to do your very best at all times and under any circumstances. Competitiveness. We all are competitive. We all want to grow and succeed. But I think that early in life, many people become discouraged as a result of negative experiences in sports. Some have coaches who embarrass them or play favorites. As a result, those people become easily discouraged and develop an attitude that says, "What's the sense in trying?" This is learned helplessness. Others are lazy. They aren't willing to do the work. Every year I get calls from athletes who say, "Mac, I should have listened to you." Many of them had plenty of natural talent, but weren't willing to put in the time and work to reach their full potential. They thought they could get by on talent alone, but later admit to themselves that they couldn't. Distractions. Some athletes lead conflicting lifestyles. They aren't willing to discipline themselves. Strawberry, whose drug addiction has led to repeated suspensions, is a poster boy for this gremlin. Author Pete Gent, a former Dallas Cowboy, said athletes hang around with people who tell them the rules don't apply to you. The athlete who thinks he can party all night and still play the next day is subject to Newton's law. What goes up must come down. In baseball, it's often his batting average that does. Persistence. Remaining optimistic during difficult times isn't easy, but the most successful people are those who look at setbacks as opportunities for comebacks. They are persistent. They refuse to lose. Look at Jim Abbott. Born without a right hand, he played 10 years in the major leagues and threw a no-hitter. Look at Lance Armstrong. The American cyclist overcame cancer and won the Tour de France 2 years in a row. Look at Kurt Warner, who went from working in a grocery store to quarterbacking the St. Louis Rams to victory in the Super Bowl. It's important to look at yourself and identify your gremlins. In sports, as in life, the first step to success is getting out of your own way. The next level. It's what you learn after you know it all that counts. Earl Weaver. Build your weaknesses until they become your strengths. Newt Rockne. A few years ago, I went to Japan and worked with a Japanese professional baseball team. It is one of my most memorable sports experiences. One thing I learned from my association with the Oryx Blue Wave is a concept called Kaizen, which means constant daily learning and improvement. This concept is used not only in sports, but also in businesses around the world, and it's wonderfully illustrated in a movie titled Mr. Baseball. In the film, Tom Selleck plays Jack Elliott, a veteran power-hitting first baseman for the New York Yankees. When Jack becomes mired in an extended hitting slump, the club replaces him in the lineup with a younger player. Elliott's agent sends Jack to Japan, where he signs a lucrative contract. When Elliott reports to his new club, the Dragons, he is an arrogant know-it-all. The former World Series MVP clashes with his Japanese manager, a rigid, no-nonsense disciplinarian. In America, it is said, you play baseball. In Japan, you work baseball. On the first day of batting practice, Jack demonstrates his power, driving fastballs, his pitch, deep into the stands. The coach then instructs his pitcher to throw some off-speed stuff. The picture of confidence, Elliott swings and misses. He swings again, bruising nothing but the air. Through an interpreter, the manager informs his new player that he has a hole in his swing. In games, opposing pitchers don't offer Elliott fastballs. The frustrated American doesn't see any, either until he admits he has a weakness and works toward patching the hole in his swing. By the end of the movie, Jack Elliott, who came to Japan with a full teacup, thinking he knew it all, becomes a better hitter and more complete player. The Japanese teach the American humility. In turn, Jack teaches his manager and Japanese teammates how to have more fun playing the game. Japanese players focus on the process of knowing themselves and improving their weaknesses. Americans seem more focused on outcome. At rookie camp, I ask every player, whether he is Alex Rodriguez or Ken Griffey Jr., to train his thoughts on the process. What can I learn today? How can I become better tomorrow? Instead of worrying about statistics and outcomes, I want them thinking about the process of learning, growing, and getting better. Learning how to learn takes work. You never stop learning in this game, said Randy Johnson, ace of the Arizona Diamondbacks pitching staff. If you ever think you know everything about the game, it will jump up and bite you hard. I believe in the parachute principle. The mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open. Athletes who hope to improve must recognize their strengths and weaknesses. Then they must work at turning their weaknesses into strengths. The great Hank Aaron, reflecting upon his early years in the major leagues, said, "I did a lot of thinking about hitting. I studied the pitchers all the time, and when I found one giving me trouble, I studied him extra hard. I wanted to know why he was getting me out and what I could do about it. Don Drysdale of the Dodgers used to get me out with a change of pace pitch. In fact, all the Dodgers used to kill me with that pitch. So after my first year, when I got home to Mobile, Alabama, I got my brother Tommy to throw changeups to me all the time. After that, they didn't throw me that pitch very often." Magic Johnson's father taught his son the value of working on every phase of his game, especially the part that needed the most work. "Dad said my opponents would always find my weaknesses and that it wouldn't take long at any level for them to start exploiting me," Johnson recalls. "He said my weaknesses would stand out like a neon sign. If I couldn't dribble with my left hand, or if I had the habit of being lazy on defense, everybody would know it. He told me that in basketball, I couldn't hide." Weekend golfers go to what they call the driving range, which actually is the practice range. Many spend 70% of their practice time seeing how far they can hit the ball, even though as much as 70% of the game is played from 100 yards in. It's human nature to practice the things we enjoy most and do well. In truth, says golfer Nancy Lopez, we should do just the opposite if we hope to improve. Pete Rose said it this way, "What's tough is to go out and work hard on the things you don't do very well." Tiger Woods reevaluated himself and his game after winning the Masters by a record margin in 1997. Recognizing his weaknesses, he made subtle changes in his swing and became more accurate and consistent off the tee. I played tournament tennis in high school and college. I had a weak backhand. When I was younger, I could run around it, so I never worked on that weakness. Now that I can't run around it, my backhand is better than my forehand. Most people resist making changes. They prefer to stay in a comfort zone. The paradox is that sometimes you have to get worse before you get better. It takes a leap of faith to make changes and work on weaknesses. What if Aaron hadn't gone back to Mobile and practiced hitting change-ups? Would he have become the hitter that he did? Probably not. What do you do well? What don't you do so well? Where are the holes in your game? Be honest with yourself and open to learning. Be accepting of your weakness rather than resisting. Develop your own action plan to turn your shortcomings into strengths. Remember, your mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open. What did you learn today? And how will it make you better tomorrow? Work on your weaknesses until they become your strong points. Part 2. Living the Dream. Good enough to dream. You must have dreams and goals if you are ever going to achieve anything in this world. Lou Holtz. Be the Dream. John Cheney. On the evening of October 4th, 1989, I couldn't get the grin off my face. I was in Chicago, my father's hometown, sitting in a box seat at a baseball park he loved. It was a rare and wondrous event, for three reasons. First, the Cubs were in the playoffs. Second, this was the first ever postseason night game at Wrigley Field. The atmosphere was as electric as the wattage that illuminated the diamond, the outfield grass, the stands, and the ivy-covered wall. On that mild evening, with a hint of fall in the air, the old ballpark took on a magical glow. But for me, the real magic was listening to the pregame introduction. I'll never forget the inner pleasure I felt when the public address announcer's metallic voice crackled over the speakers. Batting fifth, the left fielder, Dwight Smith. As I sat there beaming, my mind flashed to a day 4 years earlier. It all came back to me. The four walls, the funky furnishings, the single overhead bulb, as dim as the Wrigley Klieg lights, were bright. I was back where this story begins. Mesa, Arizona, room 106 of an economy motel. Every major league team can judge a prospect's tools, and there are five in baseball. The ability to hit, hit with power, run, catch, and throw. But how do you measure what's inside an athlete's head and heart? As the Cubs' new counselor, my job at spring training in 1985 was to interview about 30 of the club's young prospects. At our motel, I would telephone each one and ask him to come to my room. They walked in, tentatively, one at a time, every 30 minutes. Barrio kids, inner city kids, country boys, California surfers, youth on parade. Seated on a bed, I introduced myself with a smile and offered the chair across from me. "Tell me," I asked for openers, "where do you see yourself in 3 or 4 years?" That's the usual timetable for a baseball player to make it to the major leagues. Some kids shrugged. They didn't see past tomorrow. Some hadn't thought that far ahead. Most didn't have a clear definition of where they wanted to be or what they wanted to do. Asked what motivated him, one young player said candidly, "The Ford factory in Toledo." He knew he didn't want to be punching a time card there. Then Dwight Smith strolled in. I can't remember for sure what he was wearing, t-shirt and shorts, I think, but I'll never forget his smile. Smitty's face lit the room. When I asked Dwight his vision for the future, the young man who wasn't a high-round draft choice didn't hesitate. "Mac, I see myself in Wrigley Field hitting 300," he said. This kid from rural South Carolina pictured himself starting in the outfield. He even saw and heard himself singing the national anthem. Without prompting, Smitty suddenly broke into a Luther Vandross song. He had a good voice, and he knew it. Dwight Smith saw his tomorrow in vivid color. As I listened, my skin broke out in goosebumps. I was struck by his confidence and moved by the power of his dream. In 1989, Smitty made it to the big leagues. He celebrated his 26th birthday that year by finishing second to his Cubs roommate, Jerome Walton, as National League Rookie of the Year. Dwight was the only player nominated on all 24 ballots. He later sang the Star-Spangled Banner at Wrigley Field and at other major league parks as well. He ended his career in Atlanta, where he sang the anthem before a Braves playoff game and earned a World Series ring. The idea for this book came to me the day I flew to Chicago to watch Smitty play. During the flight, I began putting down on paper what I had learned about the psychology of achievement and the psychology of success. Some people, I learned, are PSO, positive sensory oriented. Others are negative sensory oriented. Positive sensory oriented people like Dwight Smith have very vivid imaginations and sensory-rich dreams. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "I have a dream." He didn't say, "I have a good idea." Wade Boggs, at age 6, knew he someday would play in the major leagues. Johnny Bench's second-grade teacher asked her students what they wanted to be when they grew up. Bench said he wanted to be a baseball player. His classmates laughed. In the 8th grade, he was asked the same question. "I said a ball player, and they laughed a little more," Bench recalls. By the 11th grade, no one was laughing. Michael Jordan said, "I think people like Julius Erving, Denzel Washington, Spike Lee, and Martin Luther King, people I admire, all created their own vision, and they didn't let anyone or anything distract them or break them down." It is said that extraordinary people live their lives backward. They create a future, and then they live into it. An exercise I teach is called ACT, or A-C-T, backward. I want you to try it. The A stands for accept your present state. Understand your strengths and weaknesses, as we discussed in the last section. C stands for create your desired state. Dwight Smith had a dream. What's your dream? Close your eyes and see yourself exactly the way you want to be. Write down what this desired state would look like. T stands for take action steps to get you there. Success is a journey of one step at a time, and the longest journey begins with the first step. Believe in the power of your dream, then act backward. Accept your present state. Create your desired state. Take action through goal setting. Progress, not perfection. I'm a firm believer in goal setting, step by step. I can't see any other way of accomplishing anything. Michael Jordan. It's all about the journey, not the outcome. Carl Lewis. Two university researchers spent years studying thousands of peak performers in industries of all kinds, including sports. What Edwin Locke and Gary Latham discovered is that people who succeed are goal-oriented. They have a vision. They create sensory-rich dreams, like those illustrated in the last section. Then they turn that vision into action through goal setting. Goal setting is a master skill for personal growth and peak performance. I can't stress this too much. Without goals, where will you go in life? If you don't know where you are headed, you're probably going to wind up somewhere other than where you want to be. Dick Hanula, one of the most successful high school swimming coaches in the country, said, "Motivation depends in a very large part on goal setting. The coach must have goals. The team must have goals. Each individual swimmer must have goals. Real, vivid, living goals. Goals keep everyone on target." Goal setting is a way of bringing the future into the present so you can take action now. Goals improve performance. Goals improve the quality of practices. They clarify expectations and help increase self-confidence by seeing yourself get better. As the swimming coach points out, goals also increase the motivation to achieve. Let's look at some basic principles of goal setting. First, you should develop performance goals as well as outcome goals. A performance goal or action goal is something you can control. If you play baseball and you want to hit 300, then you're going to have to take a certain number of pitches in batting practice. I ask major league hitters to concentrate on having 4 quality at-bats each game. That becomes their goal rather than, "I'm going to get 2 hits every game." Focusing on quality at-bats is an action goal. The outcome will take care of itself. Goals should be challenging but realistic. Setting goals for your game is an art, golfer Greg Norman said. The trick is in setting them at the right level, neither too low nor too high. A good goal should be lofty enough to inspire hard work, yet realistic enough to provide solid hope of attainment. Dick Hanula put it this way: goals must be high enough to excite you, yet not so high that you cannot vividly imagine them. Goals must be attainable, but just out of reach for now. An acronym for setting goals is SMART. The S stands for specific. Say you want to make the Little League or high school team as a third baseman. A specific goal would be to work on your fielding skills. M is for measurable. Every day I'm going to take 100 ground balls to my left. The A stands for achievable. The goal is reachable and within your control. R is for realistic. It's believable. T stands for time-bound. There is an accomplishment date. A goal is a dream with a timeline. Every goal needs a target date for completion. I encourage athletes to set daily or short-term goals. The way to achieve long-term goals is to break them down into small steps. Effective goal setting is like a staircase. Each step is an action step, an increment of progress. The old saying is, inch by inch, it's a cinch. One day I received a telephone call from the general manager of an NFL team. With concern in his voice, he said the club's young quarterback, a first-round draft pick, wasn't sleeping well. At night, he began drinking alcohol to help him sleep, which only created other problems. So I met with the player and the team executive, and we agreed to work together for a specific period of time. I was establishing a goal right there. At our first session, the player was very open with me. He talked about his 5-year contract and the size of his salary. The club expected him to take over the offense and lead his teammates to the playoffs. Management, coaches, and fans were counting on him. The responsibility felt overwhelming. The rookie had the gottas. I gotta do this. I gotta do that. He was thinking about accomplishing everything at once. He worried about the future, which he had no control over. Together, we devised a 5-year roadmap and marked it with a series of small but significant steps for him to follow. We set short-term goals, specific goals, SMART goals. After our meeting, the rookie seemed like a different person. He felt empowered. He had a can-do action plan and therefore felt more in control. Two of our greatest fears are the fear of being out of control and the fear of the unknown. Setting and attaining small goals provided the player with positive feedback and the motivation to get better. As he improved, his confidence grew. When he still was in Class A ball, a young Diamondbacks pitcher called my 1-800 hotline. He was in a panic. When I asked his problem, the major league prospect said he had started the season strong, winning 4 of 5 games. Since then, he had lost 3 in a row. He sounded more than disappointed. This kid had never had a losing record in his life and now was questioning his future in professional baseball. I began to quiz him. What was his earned run average during the 3 losses compared with the start of the season? His ERA was lower, he said. How about your first pitches? He said he was throwing more strikes. I told him that despite what he thought, he was improving. The outcomes just weren't going his way. I helped him understand that he has no control over his record. What he can control is his ERA, his walks per strikeout ratio, and his hits allowed per inning. He didn't have to be perfect. Seek progress, not perfection, I told him. What do you want to accomplish in sports? The magic begins when you set goals. What are your goals? Make a list. Write them down. This is the first step to putting your dreams into action and turning them into a reality. Goals are dreams with timelines. Turn your vision into action with goal setting. Seek progress rather than perfection. Don't shirk the work. Talent is never enough. With few exceptions, the best players are the hardest workers. Magic Johnson. The harder you work, the harder it is to surrender. Vince Lombardi. For 6 years, I spent my summers in the mountains of Flagstaff, training camp home of the NFL Cardinals. At 7,000 feet, breathing in the clean, pine-scented air, players began the task of preparing themselves physically and mentally for the grind of the upcoming season. Under the bright July sun, rookies hoping to make the team and veterans battling to keep their jobs ran sprints or gassers. They put on pads and banged heads in practice twice a day. We all want to win. Every athlete wants to succeed. But the ones who do are those who separate wanting from being willing to make the sacrifice that winning demands. After the first few days of practice, at high altitude, I could look into players' eyes, observe their body language, and tell which ones were determined to pay the price to make their dreams come true. One of those players was Ricky Prohl. I met Ricky in 1990. After his senior season at Wake Forest, he attended the NFL Scouting Combine in Indianapolis. At the Combine, hundreds of pro prospects are interviewed, weighed, measured, timed, examined, and evaluated in advance of the league's spring draft. As the Cardinals' team counselor, I interviewed dozens of players. I liked Ricky Prohl immediately. This cocky wideout from New Jersey didn't fit the NFL prototype. Most scouts thought he was undersized and probably not fast enough to compete against the pro game's hiccup-quick cornerbacks and safeties. But I liked his attitude, and I admired his confidence. Prohl had led Wake Forest in receiving 3 years in a row. He set the school record for career receptions. He saw himself playing in the NFL, just as a young Dwight Smith saw himself wearing a Cubs uniform in Wrigley Field. Other prospects who had competed against Prohl in the Atlantic Coast Conference offered testimonials to his work ethic. Ricky Prohl, he comes at you play after play. He runs perfect routes. The guy's a fighter. He never quits. I hoped the Cardinals would draft him, and they did, in the third round. 10 years later, late in the fourth quarter of the NFC Championship game, the St. Louis Rams broke from the huddle. They trailed Tampa Bay 6-5, a baseball score. Less than 5 minutes remained. Kurt Warner, the Rams quarterback, called the play. Flex left, smoke right, 585 H choice. At the snap, the team's fourth receiver took off down the left sideline. He looked up into the dome lights, eyes widening. Here it came, a tight spiral. The receiver fended off a defender with his right arm and caught the ball with his left. Touchdown. That 30-yard catch won the game and sent the Rams to the Super Bowl and put number 87, Ricky Prohl, on the cover of Sports Illustrated. "This is what I dreamed about playing in the NFL for 10 years, Prohl said that day. The kid from Wake Forest, traded by the Cardinals to a losing team in Seattle and then to a bad team in Chicago and later to a 4-12 team in St. Louis, took a lap around the Trans World Dome, clutching the George Halas NFC Championship trophy. Lars Anders, at the University of Florida, writing in a paper on deliberate practice, said he found it takes 10 years of practice to acquire the mastery of an expert. Ricky Prohl has been catching footballs for a long time, but it took him 10 years of hard work to become an overnight success. In sports, as in life, there is no substitute for commitment. Vince Lombardi called it heart power. A man can be as great as he wants to be, the Hall of Fame coach said. If you believe in yourself and have the courage, the determination, the dedication, the competitive drive, and if you are willing to sacrifice the little things in life and pay the price for the things that are worthwhile, it can be done. Once a man has made a commitment, he puts the greatest strength in the world behind him. It's something we call heart power. Once a man has made this commitment, nothing will stop him short of success. Listen to Tony Gwynn, one of baseball's best hitters. It's easy to cheat yourself and do just enough to get by, but that's what everybody can do, just enough to get by. But those who want to be successful and maintain that level of success have got to push a little bit harder and do a little bit more. Rod Carew says he has seen many baseball players blessed with God-given ability who simply didn't want to work. They are soon gone, Carew says. I've seen others with no ability to speak of who stayed in the big leagues for 14 or 15 years. You have to want to do the work. Andre Agassi fell from the top of the tennis world to number 141 in the rankings. Determined to resurrect his career, he committed to the belief that if he worked himself into top physical shape, no one could beat him. You have to work hard and establish yourself all over again, or else it's real easy to have a bad day, Agassi said. Watching him during his inspiring comeback, you could see Agassi was willing to stay out on the court for as long as he had to beat his chief rival, Pete Sampras. Rob Evans transformed the Ole Miss basketball program into a powerhouse. This is what Evans, now head coach at Arizona State, tells his players. Hey, you might not be as good as Michael Jordan, but there isn't any reason you can't play with as much effort and enthusiasm as he does. No matter where you are talent-wise, you always can play hard. What about you? Have you made a commitment to this book? Listening to the lessons for enjoyment is fine, but results come only after you cross that line and say you're going to answer the questions and do the exercises. Mental skills, like physical skills, only improve if you do the work. One of my favorite quotes is from former tennis great Bjorn Borg. I remember how I used to take the train to Stockholm every day after school to play, coming home late, studying, getting up to go to school, getting on the train again, all those years. It has gotten results. But even if it hadn't, even if I wasn't able to become a champion, I would still know that I gave it my best shot. I tried. I got on the train, and I tried. Have you boarded the train? Are you on track? If not, what are you waiting for? It takes years of hard work to become an overnight success. Are you willing to make the commitment and pay the price? Fatal distractions. Obstacles are what you see when you take your eyes off your goal. Jim Lefevre. In spite of all the distractions, remain focused on the job. Reggie Jackson. His name means almost there in Navajo. And by the end of Nota Begay's rookie year on the PGA Tour, the golf world agreed that he had arrived. Begay, a full-blooded Native American, won two tournaments in 1999. The young man who played college golf with Tiger Woods at Stanford and earned a degree in economics became a hero and a source of inspiration to his people. But 2 months after his hometown of Albuquerque, New Mexico, honored him with Nota Begay Day, the 27-year-old made embarrassing headlines when he was arrested and convicted on a drunk driving charge. After Begay told a New Mexico judge about a prior drunk driving offense in Arizona, he received a 7-day jail term. He was also fined and ordered to perform community service. To his credit, Begay put the blame squarely where it belonged. "You're looking at someone who is going to jail," Begay told a group of kids attending a junior clinic. "I would hate to see you go through what I have to, but I made a bad decision, and I am taking responsibility for that." Not long ago, I received a call from ESPN Sports. A Phoenix radio affiliate wanted to interview me, not about the mental game and athletic excellence, but rather about all the trouble we see in the sports arena. Every day, the sports pages print embarrassing and tragic headlines. Drug suspensions, domestic violence, paternity suits, crimes involving weapons, drunken driving charges, car crashes, fatalities. Having served as a counselor for several professional sports teams, I know athletes and other individuals whose careers and lives have been damaged by the bad choices and mistakes they have made. Lynn Larson earned a Super Bowl ring while playing with the old Baltimore Colts. Lynn and I once gave talks together about leadership in sports. We discussed what he calls fatal distractions. As we talked about in the previous section on goal setting, whatever your age and whatever your game, you need to focus your time and energy if you want to become successful and realize your dreams. One key to reaching your full potential as a person and an athlete is to avoid those distractions that can lead you away from your goals. Satchel Paige, the legendary pitcher and philosopher, once said, "Go very light on the vices, such as carrying on in society. The social ramble ain't restful." Satchel took his own advice, which is still valid today. I spend every Thanksgiving weekend speaking to hundreds of young people at the Griffey International Baseball Camp at Disney World in Orlando. One thing I do during the camp always gets quite a reaction. I have this fake snake. It looks very realistic. It hisses and even coils around your arm. Standing before the group, I'll reach into a cloth sack and pull out the snake and hold it up for all to see. The kids scatter. "Next time someone brings drugs to your schoolyard, I want you to do the same thing," I tell them. "Drugs are just as poisonous as this snake." Say yes to sports and no to drugs, nicotine, and supplements. Carl Lewis, the 6-time Olympic gold medalist, says there are 3 things to remember about drugs. The first is that if you take drugs, you'll never know your full potential. Second, there is the obvious health risk. And third, if you do drugs, you're quitting on yourself. I admire Joe Garagiola. The broadcaster and former big league catcher is leading the campaign against smokeless tobacco. Garagiola's good friend, Bill Tuttle, developed cancer of the mouth after chewing tobacco for years. Brett Butler, a tobacco user, had a cancerous tumor removed from his throat. Joe talks to major league players in an effort to get them to consider the effects of tobacco on their health, as well as the potential impact the habit can have on kids. Supplements of all kinds are readily available. During the 1999-2000 NBA season, Phoenix Suns forward Tom Gugliotta took a dietary supplement which he said was given to him by an old high school friend to help him sleep. Seated on the team bus after a game in Portland, Gugliotta suffered a seizure that temporarily caused him to stop breathing. He was hospitalized and connected to a respirator. "I took something I really didn't know too much about," Gugliotta said. "That's not right to do, and it almost cost me my life." Follow your goals and not the crowd. Former Olympic swimming champion Janet Evans said, "Sometimes I feel envious when my friends go to parties and I have to go to bed. But my friends always tell me that the parties really aren't that much fun anyway. Whatever I've missed, I've made up for. Most kids don't get to go to the Olympics and win 3 gold medals. It's definitely been worth it." As a teenager, basketball star Kevin Johnson went to the gym every evening to practice. One evening, the janitor said to him, "Kevin, it's Saturday night. Why aren't you out at parties like everybody else?" "Parties," Johnson replied, "won't take me where I want to go." Don't do anything to embarrass yourself, your family, or the team. Joe Gibbs preached this when he coached the Washington Redskins teams that played in the Super Bowl. Joe Bugle, a former Gibbs assistant, made it his number one rule when he became head coach of the Arizona Cardinals. Associate with people who will make you better. Richard Dumas, a promising talent with the Phoenix Suns, battled drug problems. He got into trouble during the offseason when he returned home to Tulsa and fell into the company of old friends. Sometimes you have to let go of old friendships in order to stay on track to reach your goals. Be big enough to back away from trouble. Many athletes become targets. Branch Rickey told the great Jackie Robinson that he didn't want someone who was big enough to handle trouble. He wanted someone who was big enough to walk away from it. Today, some athletes arm themselves with handguns. In my opinion, nothing good comes from carrying a weapon. Don't abuse alcohol. Golfer John Daly is only one example of a gifted athlete whose personal and professional life has been torn apart by alcohol. Drinking ruined more than one marriage and cost Daly millions in endorsement contracts. "I know now," said Dwight Gooden, a former Cy Young Award winner, "that it was drinking that destroyed my fastball." Drinking and driving cost a promising young player with the Arizona Diamondbacks his life. If you are of legal age and drink alcohol, follow Newt Rockne's rule. Drink the first, sip the second, and refuse the third. Take responsibility for your life and your actions. Too many successful athletes don't think the rules of society apply to them. What you find depends upon where you look. Stay focused on your goals and avoid the fatal distractions. Say yes to your dreams and no to drugs. Fate loves the fearless. Really, it comes down to your philosophy. Do you want to play it safe and be good, or do you want to take a chance and be great? Jimmy Johnson. The bottom line is, you can't be afraid to fail. Jerry Colangelo. There is a saying in baseball that you can't steal second with your feet on first. Whenever I hear that, Max,